Kevin Orr, the emergency financial manager of Detroit, began his first day on the job this morning. Protesters descended on City Hall. On today's show, we get the latest from Detroit. And we speak with the new chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. We'll ask Lon Johnson just what Democrats need to do to win the governor's office in 2014. Now, here's a question for you. Could you be fired for being gay in Michigan? Could you be fired if your boss even thinks you might be gay? And would you have any legal recourse if that happened to you? Michigan Radio's Lester Graham has begun exploring the issues of legal discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered persons in our state, the LGBT community. It's all part of an occasional series from Michigan Watch. His first three reports are running on Michigan Radio today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. And Lester joins me now in the studio. Lester, very good to have you here.
Hi, thanks.
So let's start with the answer to those questions. Can I be fired for being gay or if a boss thinks I might be gay?
Absolutely. If your hair's a little too short and you wear manly clothes, you can be fired for that. If the boss thinks that you're a guy and you're dressing a little too effeminate, he can fire you for that. There are no protections for LGBT people or anyone that somebody thinks might be LGBT. It's just as simple as saying you're gone. Now, this is an at-will state, so employers don't have to tell you why you're fired or give any kind of cause for why you're fired. So most of them don't say that. But when you see a corporation fire three people who are known to be LGBT members right in a row, it's pretty suspicious.
And under Michigan's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, there are lots of folks who do have that kind of protection, right?
Right. I mean, you're protected based on religion, your race, your color, your national origin, your age, your sex. You can't be discriminated against because of your height, your weight, your family status and marital status. But, boy, if you're gay, you're just out of luck.
And how far back does that act go?
It was part of the original Constitution in 64.
Right.
But we've had these kinds of protections for much longer in Michigan. And the Michigan Department of Civil Rights and the Michigan Civil Rights Commission have been saying since the 70s we ought to extend these kind of protections to LGBT members. In fact, there was a recent report that made those kinds of recommendations to the commission again. But it's never really gone anywhere. It's been voted on in the past, but it's never really gone
anywhere.
Why? Well, I think it really comes down to, some would say, moral conscience. Others would say bigotry.
And we're seeing, certainly as on the national level, we're seeing the mood shifting in favor of allowing gays to marry. So we're seeing that kind of evolution. What's the public mood in Michigan towards all of this?
Well, there's a Michigan State University survey last year. It was conducted by Charles Ballard, and it says overall, and just on the gay marriage subject alone, they say 56% are in favor, 39% against. And they broke that down along some religious lines, too, which I thought was important because when we passed the constitutional amendment in 2004 that defined marriage as only between one man and one woman, and any similar union is not going to be recognized, it was done because of a campaign that was funded, for the most part, by the Catholic diocese in the state. Okay. And so Charles Ballard broke it down, and he found out that Catholics are just about the same as the rest of the state. In fact, 58% are in favor of gay marriage, while 56% overall. It's the Protestants who are less favorable, have less favorable views toward that. People with no religious preferences at all are mostly in favor of gay marriage. They see it as a justice issue.
I think I'm hearing that Michigan's Catholics are somewhat disconnected from the bishops who are running the archdiocese.
Or the reverse.
Or the reverse, the bishops being disconnected with what the
But you know,
want.
The Catholic Church is not going to change its doctrine because of polling. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
But the membership, those people who identify as Catholic, are definitely moving with the rest of society and saying, hey, what's this hurt? Who's this going to harm? In the meantime, all these other discrimination issues against LGBT members are being pushed back by those who are anti-gay rights folks, because they're afraid if we get, as we have in some other states, rights for LGBT, if we protect them, then the state Supreme Court, as has happened in other states, could say, well, look, we grant these people all these other rights. Why shouldn't they have the right to marry, too? That's what's happened in some, in at least three other states. And so there's a great concern. You grant civil rights to LGBT, and the next thing you know, those folks are going to be able to get married.
I wonder, with knowing that the U.S. Supreme Court's taking up two very, very important cases with gay rights, what
week.
Impact they might have on this.
Well, I mean, it could change everything. In the when they rule on it in June, we don't know. Though in the meantime, we're kind of in this limbo state. In fact, there's a case, a federal case, that brought by a lesbian couple who each want to adopt each other's kids for more security for the kids. And the judge said, there's no sense ruling on this. We might as well wait for the Supreme Court.
So they're in limbo until all of this comes down.
Everything's in limbo, right. But in the meantime, no matter what you think about same-sex marriage, we're discriminating against people just because they're gay. We can fire them. We can stop them from, we don't have to serve them in restaurants or bars. You can be turned away at a hotel in the state. Not very good for pure Michigan tourism, that's for sure. If you get the word out that, hey, if you're gay, don't go to Michigan because they can turn you away. So that is happening. At the same time, the private sector is saying, we're going to put policies in place to protect LGBT people. We'll be talking about that a little bit tomorrow because we know it's good business. You recognize diversity. So the politicians and the private sector are kind of out of sync on this.
And what about documented cases or complaints? Have there been any of LGBT people who have been discriminated against this
way? Right. The American Family Association's Gary Glenn has indicated there are no documented cases. And at this point, I have not found a documented case, but that's because there is no law to protect them. So how do you document a case when there is no law to protect them? Now, there are 22 municipalities that have passed LGBT protecting ordinances.
So they're doing it on the local level.
Right. And they vary widely in what they do. Some are just resolutions. Some of them are pretty stringent. But for instance, in Ann Arbor, as we've reported today, in Ann Arbor, their human rights department has been kind of shut down because of budget cuts for the last 6 years. You're not getting much out of there. I have contacted some of the other cities, such as Kalamazoo and East Lansing and Detroit. I filed FOIA requests. Yeah. FOIA requests sometimes take a little while to be fulfilled. We're still waiting on Detroit in the meantime, in Kalamazoo and in East Lansing and in Ann Arbor. We've seen very, very few cases filed and even fewer actually acted on, some kind of resolution, because there just aren't that many people. Now, why?
Yes.
Gary Glenn says, well, it's because there's no need.
So he's saying it's like a problem.
Yeah, there is no solution. It's a solution looking for a problem.
Yes, yes.
The advocates for the LGBT community say, no, really, come on. We are not that advanced as a society. People are not willing to come out of the closet. A lot of times they don't know about the local ordinance. When they find out that they can't take anybody to court, you have to kind of trust the local Human Rights Commission or Civil Rights Commission. And the other thing that's going on is you might be a resident of Kalamazoo and feel you're being discriminated against or fired because you were being discriminated against. But the company that did the action is in a different city or in the township or beyond the city limits, so the city has no jurisdiction over that situation, which the advocates for LGBT protection say that's why we need this in the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, so the state has a statewide policy.
So is there a formal push to revise the act?
There's always been a low-level push, but because this whole LGBT issue has really been speeding forward over the last 3 to 4 years, and particularly in the last 12 months, it's getting a lot more attention. And again, because the Michigan Department of Civil Rights recently issued this report and has asked the commission to look at it and approve it, and the commission may ask the legislature, hey, isn't it time we protect LGBT members in the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act? So it's coming. That controversy might be coming to the legislature soon.
Lester's reports will be running on Michigan Radio News today, Tuesday and Wednesday. And, of course, you can always go to MichiganRadio.org and click on. You'll find transcript and be able to listen to that interview so you can share it as well. Lester, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a magic to the act of putting pen to paper and writing down your thoughts and your wishes, writing a letter. You can save that letter, and no matter when you open it later on, there you are, right in the moment with the emotions of that moment, connecting with the person to whom you were writing. Well, that magic certainly touched a Niles man recently, Bob Rogers. The postmaster of New Carlisle, Indiana, knocked on Bob's door and handed the 79-year-old man a letter, a very, very special letter. Bob Rogers joins us now from Niles. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
So, Bob, tell us, what was that letter that you received?
It was one of the first letters I had written to my dear wife. I mailed it in June the 15th, 1953, when I was starting basic training in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, in the 503rd, 11th Airborne Army Engineers.
So there you were, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. You were, what, 20 years old?
Yes, ma'am.
Private Rogers, trying to figure out what boot camp was all about. So you mailed that letter, Bob, but Jean never got it?
She never got it, no.
And 60 years later, somebody finds it? What did you think when you saw that letter in your hand?
Well, it was very hard to comprehend that that after almost 60 years, I got a letter that I had written to my wife proclaiming that that I was just starting basic training, and I very much missed her, and I was regretted being away. My thoughts were, geez, if I could just get a telephone call from you and just hear your voice, that would make me happy. So I was just explaining to her that I was supposed to be inducted into the 27th Engineering Battalion in the 3rd Army.
And this, of course, was during the Korean War, so you didn't get to choose whether or not you served Uncle Sam, did you?
Well, I chose to serve my country, and what hurt was I got married a year before on Thanksgiving Day, not thinking that I was going to be drafted, but so we didn't have much of married life before I got inducted, so it was kind of heartbreaking, but at that point in time, I didn't seem to have much to do other than be part of it.
And then how long were you in the Army, Bob?
I was in the Army for two years, 53 to 55.
And then you came home.
Then I came home.
And you moved with Jean to Niles? In
yes.
1956, and you've been there ever since.
I've been there ever since.
Now, I know, Bob, that Jean passed away 8 years ago. Do you think she was up there enjoying your walk back in time as you read that letter?
Oh, gosh. She would have got a hoot out of this. She would have really got a charge out of it, I'll tell you, if she was here. And I was asked a few times, didn't I miss her not getting this letter? And my reply was, not really, because I wrote her every day.
I got to say, you have to give credit to the United States Postal Service. It may have taken 60 years, but they did get that letter to you.
Well, the Postmaster General said, we deliver that on time. We don't mess up delivering our mail. If something happened that it was returned into the mailbox and sent somewhere else. Said that probably ended up in the flea market, and somebody had returned it to the post office, and that's when I got it. And I said, did you believe that? And he says, not for a minute.
But it was sure good to see that letter in your hand, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. There's nothing on the letter that says it's to return the sender or anything. And I put, I needed only a 3-cent stamp. But I wanted to make sure she got it, so I put 2 3-cent stamps on it.
Well, Bob, we want to thank you for your service, first of all. And we want to thank you for talking with us and sharing your story with us today.
It's a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of good bluegrass music and good bluegrass musicians, You might think of folks coming from the mountain hollows of West Virginia or Kentucky. That is where bluegrass began, taking the music brought by Irish, Scottish, and English settlers and maybe mixing in some elements of African-American music and producing a wonderful American music. But today you're going to meet some pretty incredible musicians who can serve up some great bluegrass and a whole lot of other styles of music. They come from Michigan, so it's Bluegrass Michigan Style is served up by Lindsay Liu and the Flatbellies. Joining us in the studio today, we have Lindsay Liu and Joshua Rilko. Lindsay Liu is the singer-songwriter. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Joshua plays mandolin and sings. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
And they are married, so we have love and music all mixed in. So tell us, where are you and the other members of the band from? What parts of Michigan grew you?
Well, I grew up in the Upper Peninsula in Iron Mountain, Kingsford area. And Spencer Kane, who plays bass with us, grew up in Alpena, so also northernly. Mm-hmm. Mark Lavengood plays dobro with us, and he grew up in the Grand Rapids area, Comstock Park.
And Keith and I are from the Tri-City area. He's from Midland.
Okay.
And I'm from Saginaw.
So you're truly from all over the state of Michigan. Yeah. And I know that you say that Lindsay Liu and the Flatbellies, which, by the way, I just adore the name of the band, is a genreless band. But it certainly seems as though you really do know your way around bluegrass. Was that kind of your roots and where you grew from?
Well, I would say my roots would be folk music, you know. I grew up in a musical family. My mom had 12 brothers and sisters, and I was just talking to my grandma, and she said we've got 30 first cousins and 40 second cousins. So a lot of people, a lot of music, and a lot of love. You know, I grew up singing Beatles songs and the Indigo Girls, and so those were my roots, really.
Yeah.
And then when I met Joshua, he was already in a band called the Flatbellies.
Okay.
And they were playing bluegrass. And I've been writing songs my whole life on the piano and on the guitar. But it was more singer-songwriter, like solo singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I met Joshua, it was what's really cool about bluegrass is such an important part of it is harmony singing. So coming from a musical family where we
You're
all
used
got
to that.
Yeah, that was like heaven meeting a group of people my age who I could sing harmonies with. And so I started playing with them for that reason, because it was just felt so much like home.
Mm.
And a genre really just provides the framework to access music, a deeper thing that is, you know, music with a capital M.
And what about you, Joshua, your background?
Well, I've always really loved playing music. So when I was younger, I took piano lessons and I started playing guitar in middle school and that kind of stuff, got into punk rock and loud electric guitars and stuff like that, and had a lot of fun doing that kind of stuff in high school. And then I started getting more into acoustic music, and I realized that if I want to play a lot of music, that's kind of the genre to be in, because everyone is so interested in getting together casually and just playing music all the time, not just in a band for performance reasons.
Well, break it down for us from the inside out, because you are practitioners of it. What are the elements of the music and the vocals that make something good bluegrass?
Well, Bill Monroe would say, Bill Monroe's the father of bluegrass, mm-hmm. and he would say you got to have good high tenor, you know, a very clear, crisp, something that cuts through, and you can hear that in those old recordings. Mm-hmm. You know, Bill would sing lead on the verses, but he would jump up and sing the high harmony, high baritone, or high tenor, and just a tight three part or two part harmony that's, you know, they call it the brother harmony or the sibling harmony, where you're following each other really closely. It's not like arranged parts. It's you're singing the same thing, but in intervals.
There's also no drums in bluegrass, usually, most of the time.
Okay.
And so for it to be good, everyone has to work together with their instruments to kind of create a drum kit of sorts with their string instruments. So then when they all play together, it has a nice pulsing, driving rhythm, even though there's no percussion.
Yeah, and like marked dynamic shifts,
yeah.
which the drum kit would do, but we all have to work together and make those dynamic shifts happen
You have a track on your album that is called Tied Down to You. And to me, I was hearing echoes of a speakeasy and bathtub gin. It felt like something I should hear on Boardwalk Empire. Tell me the story behind that song.
Well, that song was written in Colorado. Joshua and I got married July 23rd, 2011. And we left the day after we got married and went on a honeymoon with the band. Of course, the traditional way of doing these things. It was our first tour to Colorado. And I was listening to the Bluegrass Junction on the radio. And the song came on talking about being tied down and about how terrible it is, you know. And
typical bluegrass song.
Moaning about something.
Yeah. And here I am, you know, last day of this epic tour, epic week. I just married,
Love of your life.
Yeah. And I'm like overflowing with every positive sentiment I could possibly have.
Yeah.
So I turned off the radio and I wrote the entire song in the 45-minute drive between Denver and Lyons, Colorado.
My dear, I'm tied down to you like rubber to glue. Yes, sir, I do, and I will love you stay. No matter come what may, I will love you every day, and I will stay tied down to you.
And we've been listening to the song we've been talking about, Tied Down to You, listening to a sample of it from your CD, Release Your Shroud, your newest album. You've got a track on there called Leaves and Pods, and it's just made for this time of the year in Michigan. So this is where I think the Michigan feel of your bluegrass music comes in. Tell us about Leaves and Pods.
Well, so I lived in Ecuador for about 5 months, right in the Andes Mountains in Quito, Ecuador. And it was 75 and sunny every day. And that sounds really great, but this was the longest I had spent. I was there January through May, so I missed all of pretty much the most dramatic part of the Michigan seasons. I just missed all of it.
And the winter into spring part.
The winter into spring, where there have been times I remember thinking, I don't think I can make it. I'm not going to make it through the month of February. Yeah, slush and snow and cold. And every time you get in your car, it's so cold. So having gone through that, when spring rolls around, there's nothing like that. Because of where you just came from, you know, every bit of sunshine is just soaked up like crazy. So I got back and it was still summer. It was still like 75 and sunny. And I was thinking, man, I just can't wait until the leaves start to change. And that the smell of the air changes, you know, when you start wearing your sweaters and it gets cozy. So I was really excited for that. And then was really excited for the snow crunch. Like all of these things that I had grown up with my whole life.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, Michigan. It's like remembering it for the first time.
I forgot that sweetness can be in hair, that the soil we stand on tells a
perfect time to be able to enjoy that. If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're profiling the band Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies, a bluegrass band, and a whole lot more as we talk with Lindsay Lou and Joshua Rilko. Lindsay Lou, talk about the vocal style that's really uniquely yours. You have a very unique sound. So tell us a little about what you do as you approach a vocal, and then give us a little sample.
I think I learned how to sing from my mom and my Auntie Melody. And I have a voice that's similar to my mom's. My vibrato is really similar to hers. One of my idols singing was Nat King Cole growing up, which, I mean, he just has a voice like butter, you know? It's so good. And then I met Rachel Davis, who's a Michigan artist. She lives in Nashville now, but she's a part of the Earthwork Collective. And she probably maybe has had the most influence on me because I was able to be her friend and watch her sing and really informal settings, and that just had such influence on me. This is a brand new song. It goes, when my eyelids are sinking, my bones are shaking, my skin is crawling, I feel like making my way to the bedroom to waste myself with spell. But the band is swinging, the mantle's ringing. If I could, I would keep singing. It's a too late now, tomorrow I'll feel like hell. Oh, and that's the way it always goes. That's my story from start to close. I'm holding it down in limbo.
Beautiful. Let me ask both of you for your thoughts. What do you think that musicians and audiences of today could learn from the traditions of the past? What do you think, Joshua?
Well, this is my opinion, but I really like the in bluegrass, I like that idea of just getting up on stage in front of one mic and letting your instruments and your voices do the work, because you just have that one mic. So it's kind of up to you to make the music happen. So it's just a very intimate experience. And I think that nowadays, you know, we've got all this electricity pumping our sound out, and sometimes that's necessary for sure. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of just having it stripped back down.
Real pure. Yeah. How about you, Lindsay Lou?
I think on a more abstract level, you always have to know, or should know, it would behoove you to know where you came from in order to figure out where you're going. You know, it's really applicable in music. Like I was saying before, as a musician, we're all trying to access this music with a capital M. We're all trying to tap into some human emotion or expression via and use music as the medium. And a lot of people have figured out different ways of doing this. That's kind of like the idea of a genre, is these different ways that people have come up with of doing that. And it's only going to make you better to know what these people have done who did it so well.
You can check out Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies. You can follow them, of course, on Facebook, or check them out on the web at lindsayloumusic.com. And we have been talking with Lindsay Lou and Joshua Rilko. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Still ahead, Detroit's new emergency financial manager had his first day on the job today. We'll get an update. Then we speak with the new chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. What are his plans for winning the governor's office and more in 2014? That story comes up in 10 minutes here on Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was an historic day, not just here in Michigan, but nationally. Detroit officially became the largest city in the nation to come under control of a state-appointed manager. Kevin Orr turned up at the Coleman A. Young Municipal Building at 7:30 this morning to start his first day on the job as Detroit's new emergency financial manager. And as Orr plunged into what even he calls an Olympian task, some protesters were making sure they were on the scene, in their words, defending democracy. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick's been covering the story today, and she joins us now from Detroit. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, glad to be here.
So what can you tell us about what Kevin Orr has been doing on this big day one?
Well, he came to work apparently at about 7 or 7:30 by a secret route, he said. He is going to be working downtown in City Hall, right in the Coleman A. Young Municipal Center. In fact, apparently he has an office within the mayor's office, so he will be working down there. And this morning he participated in a joint press conference with the mayor, Dave Bing, in which they both pledged to work together as they have before as sort of a team. and or is going to be and is in the process right probably right about now of meeting with members of the Detroit City Council.
And of course, it is worth noting that when the new emergency manager law takes effect this Thursday and Kevin Orr transitions from emergency financial manager to an emergency manager, that law wipes out the salaries and benefits of the mayor and city council, doesn't it? But he can restore their pay at a level he sees fit?
He said that he will make a decision about that, about the pay for elected officials this week. So it's not quite clear yet what he's going to do, but we should find out soon.
Now, I know that there were calls from the pulpit all around Detroit churches on Sunday and also from the Reverend Jesse Jackson calling for protesters to line Kevin Orr's way into work this morning. How many actually turned out this morning?
Well, I don't know if they knew Kevin Orr's route exactly, so I can't really say what the presence was as he was coming in early this morning. But there were some protesters outside the Coleman Young Municipal Center, outside City Hall, and in different spots around the city this past weekend, too. And it's really sort of the beginning of what people who have campaigned against the emergency manager law say that they are in the process of putting together a sort of mass movement that will utilize civil disobedience and protest and all sorts of different methods to try and stop what they think is a big injustice in an emergency manager, particularly in Detroit. The crowd, I don't think, was too large at the City Hall protest. It seemed to be mostly people who are sort of a core group of people who are very much against emergency managers and against Governor Snyder and what he's been doing. But we'll see if those sort of grow over time.
Now, I know there were buses of protesters that left from Eastern Market today headed for Cleveland. Can you talk about that and why were protesters from Detroit headed to Cleveland?
Well, before Kevin Orr became the emergency manager here in Detroit, he was a very successful attorney for a law firm called Jones Day, which is, he was based out of Washington, but apparently they have offices in Cleveland. And many people who are against Kevin Orr, against this whole idea of an emergency manager, think that his background presents a kind of conflict of interest because he's a bankruptcy attorney, and they would argue in many cases that Kevin Orr is sort of looking out for the particular interests of bondholders of financial institutions and what's going to be one of his major tasks, which is, you know, renegotiating some of the city's massive long-term debt. Kevin Orr did resign from his job immediately after being hired as the emergency manager, so he says he has no direct conflict of interest at this point, but some of these opponents do note that Jones Day, this law firm, has in the past represented some of the banks and financial institutions that hold some of Detroit's debt. So they are very suspicious of his background.
And then we've also seen, apparently, the day that Kwame Kilpatrick was actually convicted was also the day that the city of Detroit retained Jones Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, it was.
So there's that's an intriguing hire on at the time that this is all coming down.
Absolutely, and that was a very interesting week, as I believe has been noted around town, that probably a historic week that the former mayor went to jail for what was apparently a giant racketeering conspiracy, and Detroit got really on the path to getting an emergency manager.
Sarah Swick, thanks for talking with us today. Sarah Swick reporting from Detroit.
Thank you so much.
Well, it was a month ago that the longtime leader of the Michigan Democratic Party lost his job. Mark Brewer withdrew from the race for party chair at the Democratic Party's convention in Detroit in February. His challenger, Lon Johnson, was officially elected the new chairman shortly after Brewer's concession. Lon Johnson grew up in southeast Michigan. He currently lives outside Kalkaska with his wife, Juliana Smoot, who's a former top fundraiser for President Obama. Johnson ran for a state House seat this past election and lost. He's also worked on political campaigns, including one for Michigan Democratic Congressman John Dingell. Johnson's supporters say it was time for a new face to lead the Democratic Party in Michigan, that new energy and new ideas were needed. Well, joining us now, a month on the job, is the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, Lon Johnson. Welcome to Stateside, Lon.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, as I mentioned, there was certainly a lot of talk running up to the party convention and the race between you and Mark Brewer about Michigan's Democrats needing to rejuvenate themselves and move the party forward. Why do you feel that was needed?
Well, you know, in the last six presidential campaigns that we fought together for, we won. In the last six Senate campaigns we fought together for, we won. And I think there was a recognition in the party that we need to retool to start winning at the state level. And that's what this race was about, was, you know, who should lead that and how should that be done? How do we start winning on the state level?
Yeah, because Michigan voters have that interesting tendency, sending Democrats to D.C. and Republicans to Lansing. Why do you think that has been the case?
Well, I can just speak to, you know, what we need to do moving forward. Mm-hmm. We need to recognize first that the campaigns are no longer just six-month affairs, you know, June to October or June to November in election year. We have to start working now. We have to, you know, this is a 365-day process, engaging voters engaging them and talking about the issues that matter. You know, Democrats, we have greater shared values with the voters of Michigan than the Republicans do. So when we lead with our values and we talk about how we want to put that to work in Lansing, we will win. But we have to rethink this. We have to start playing longer, not only smarter, faster, and harder, but just longer. And that's what we're working towards now.
All right. I have to ask you, as you say that really, you know, the idea of election season, it really needs to be year round. Does that run in at odds with what the public's complaint is, that lawmakers, instead of focusing on issues, are focusing on how is it playing to the constituency because of being reelected? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, this isn't, when I say, you know, working year-round, this isn't, you know, having candidates start their robocalls, you know,
right.
You know, and then you start seeing commercials. But it start to engaging with the public on showing them what's happening in Lansing. You know, what's happening in Lansing and how that affects them. Those are the processes that we need to start. You know, that goes beyond just candidates and campaigns.
All right, I'm going to use a sports metaphor here, maybe too much March Madness at my house. But here it seems, like from the outside, that the Democrats have been on the defense rather than the offense in the state legislature, constantly opposing what the Republicans are doing, but not offering big new visions of their own. Do you think that's a fair view?
Well, I think voters, elections are about the future, and elections, you know, and issues. Governing is about, you know, proposing solutions to problems that we face, and that's where we have a great difference with the Republicans, and we need to make that difference known. You know, this governor wants to, you know, for example, bring in emergency managers. We think we should govern and partner with local cities. This governor thinks cutting nearly $1 billion out of education is the right way to go. We feel that we should invest in education and work with our school boards. This governor thinks that rolling back environmental protections and giving more essentially accountability to businesses instead of taking accountability away from people who harm the environment is the way to go. We feel that we should set the standard of how our environment gets protected. Those are the kind of arguments we need to be making and make them earlier and more often.
Am I hearing you say that perhaps that was not done effectively up until now?
Well, you know, that's one way of saying, one way of saying it. Yes, you know, we haven't been doing the job of clearly we're losing these elections. And, you know, I don't believe that the Michigan voter changes values when they vote on the national elections, the federal elections, and then they go to the state. We have to do better of making our case to the Michigan voter. And that starts, you know, that's what our debate was at a convention. And that's what I'm doing now.
And in what way? What does that look like? How are you going about kind of rolling up your sleeves and changing that dynamic?
Well, it's working with, you know, the House and the state, you know, state House and state Senate, not only in recruiting good candidates, but also determining what is our message. It's making sure that we at the party have we create the right message structure and give these candidates the tools they need to start winning.
Crystallize for me, if you will, Lon Johnson, as chair of Michigan's Democratic Party, what is it to be a Democrat? What is the message of the Michigan Democratic Party to voters?
Well, you know, it means creating a Michigan where people can stay and succeed. It means investing in and protecting our two greatest assets, our people and our land. Winning elections is more than just an opportunity. It's an obligation, because when Democrats don't win, it means Michigan discriminates. Losing means politicians decide. Winning means women choose. Losing means our schools suffer. Winning means our kids compete. Losing means emergency managers. Winning means local control. Losing means right to work. Winning means protecting workers' rights. Winning matters.
Now, in 2014, Governor Snyder is up for re-election, as is the Attorney General, as is the Secretary of State. Are those seats winnable for Democrats?
Absolutely. You know, this is by all means, Michigan's a Democratic state, and that's most recently evidenced by the fact that, the president won here by 9 percentage points, despite having hardly come here. He never came here, had very little campaign presence, and was outspent nearly 2-1, maybe even 3-1, and this was Romney's home state. And the president won here by 9 points. Senator Stabenow won by over 20 points. This is a Democratic state. So when we lead with our values and we show voters who we are, we win. And we need to start doing that at the state level.
And you mentioned right to work, and we know that that law goes into effect this week. And unions and labor groups have so been tied with the Democratic Party. So let me ask you, how do you think right to work will change the Democratic Party in Michigan going forward?
Well, we are the UAW. We are the Teamsters. We are the MEA and MFT. But most importantly, we're the Michigan Democratic Party. We are the MDP. And when we are the MDP and when we are the MDP, we win. And, if we want a party that's greater than the sum of our parts, we're going to have to work together. And that's what we're working now to do. Again, we're 4 weeks into my new chairmanship, and we're working now to build all those pieces together to run effective and winning campaigns.
I'm speaking with Lon Johnson, who is the new chair of Michigan's Democratic Party. Do you think, Lon, it's time for the Democratic Party to rely less on labor?
Well, we've got great institutions in our state, and Michigan voters and the Democratic Party have done great things with our institutional partners. In fact, we've changed Michigan, we've changed the world because of it. But at the same time, we have to learn how we make the party more open to individuals. What the president showed us is that individuals, making small steps can create big change. And I believe you have the institutions and the MDP that's now going to be open to that. By figuring out how we work with institutions and make room at the table for individuals, can we win? And that's what we're doing now.
I want to get you to talk a little about the announcement from Senator Carl Levin. Of course, he's been a Michigan senator since 1979, but he's not going to run for re-election in 2014. And we're hearing names being thrown out as possible contenders on the Democratic side, Debbie Dingell and Congressman Gary Peters. Obviously, you're not ready to throw out names. It is early and confirm who's in and who's out. So let's talk about this race in general, held for so mm-hmm. long by a Democrat. What do Michigan Democrats have to do to keep that Senate seat blue?
Well, we just have to lead with our values. As I said earlier, we have the last six Senate campaigns that we fought together for, we won. And so what we're conducting a process now to find the best candidate to go out there and win. Somebody who can develop, the campaign and can put together the team to win in a protracted, year and a half long fight. We're starting with a terrific baseline, and that is Michigan's a Democratic state. But that being the case, we still have to go out there and make our case to the Michigan voters.
At what point do you expect to be unveiling candidates to run for governor?
Well, it's still early. Remember, let's think of the timeline here. We went right from the 2012 elections into the lame duck legislature that produced Right to Work, and then we went into the holidays. Then we went into the inaugural, and then we went into a chairs fight. We're just now coming out of that. And, we're seeking now some consensus around both the Senate and the governor candidates, and then obviously the other statewide from there.
And leading up to that 2014 election, give us your sense of what is the single biggest defining issue you think we'll be talking about.
Well, there's no single defining issue, but it will be about, creating a Michigan that invests in and protects our two greatest assets. That's our people and our land. Creating a Michigan where people can stay here and succeed. And we lay out those visions. And there's a lot of things that make up that. It's education, it's economic policy, it's environmental policy, it's women's rights. It's a host of issues that make up that protecting and investing in our two greatest assets, our people and our land. And that's where that's where we'll seek to contrast ourselves from the Republicans. And that's where we, frankly, will, I think, find a receptive audience, and we have. Continuously, like I said, in the last six presidential campaigns, we've won.
Lon Johnson is chairman of Michigan's Democratic Party. Lon, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside. I know we'll be talking a lot down the road.
Terrific. Thank you very much for having me on the show.